Welcome to the Command Line Podcast for May 28th, 2013. I'm your host, Thomas Command Line Gideon, a self-proclaimed hacker, eccentric, and hacktivist. This is my show about the practice and profession of programming, drawing on well over a decade of professional experience and a lifetime spent hacking, the intersection of technology with society and public policy, and anything else clever, elegant, or funny that catches my mind as a diehard technology geek. This episode is a newscast in which I discuss several of the stories that caught my attention over the past handful of weeks, including a new app that exposes Android spyware, asking the question, and considering the ramifications of which, of whether supercomputing has hit a wall, one-time pads have been reinvented to potentially make electronic copying impossible, and France is set to dump its Three Strikes Anti-Piracy Agency, but in some form or another, this regime unfortunately will live on. All of this and more. First, though, a few explanations and, well, a bit of a tease for the next episode. First is to explain that this past week's show was missed because I had set it up to release an interview that just didn't come off after several attempts over the course of the weekend to sit down with the person I was interested in talking to. It just didn't come together, as sometimes happens. That's entirely fair. And really, my fault here is that I didn't have a plan B, that I didn't have some other feature cast to go with. That, however, does lead me to the tease. The person that I've been trying to connect with and did successfully do so this past Thursday before I went to Balticon was Bruce Schneier, who's been on the show before, although it was some time ago, about 5.5 years ago. He's thinking about his next book and asked me to interview him to talk about some of his recent writing. We had a fantastic conversation that I cannot wait to share with you next week. I've got that in the can, and all that's needed, thankfully, is a little bit of light editing, some mixing and mastering, and that'll be ready to share on time next week. Also, you'll probably notice that this episode is a day late, and that's because, as I mentioned, I was at Balticon this past weekend, Memorial Day weekend, and while I got home on time, I didn't have as much of the show written last week during my staycation, for those who follow me on the social medias, to get writing done. I got a little more than half of this episode written and needed Monday night to get that finished up, and rather than pushing on top of being tired from a very full and quite wonderful convention, I decided to delay a day so I would be refreshed and ready to go, energized to chat with you about some of the stories that have come up in the past handful of weeks, especially since so many of them have come up and I haven't had an opportunity to discuss them yet. I'm not really sure what's going to happen with audio that was recorded at Balticon. I did not actually take my portable kit in with me into some of the discussions, but they were apparently well covered otherwise, and it's just, I think, going to be a matter of time before I find out from the person who has taken over coordinating the new media track for this past year how he plans to distribute that out. Regardless, I think the conversations, as good as they were topics that have been very well covered in the archives. I don't think you're missing out if I don't get a chance to share that, and I think it's a special benefit for those listeners and other folks interested in the topic who do manage to make it to Balticon to have maybe that privilege for it to be time and place dependent. Regardless, if I do get them, I'll let you know, and we'll just slot them into the production queue as they come up. Otherwise, there's plenty more of show ideas, and I think a few more interview subjects that I have in queue that hopefully you'll be hearing from over the next handful of weeks. Like many of you, I have a home network and several systems to secure, so I follow reports of security vulnerabilities with special interest. Each week, I pick a couple of those to talk about here, both to cement them in my mind and to raise some awareness. The H's Security Channel had news of an alert from Microsoft's Malware Protection Center. They claim to have identified browser extensions that can hijack a user's Facebook profile. The extensions, JSFebipause.a, spotted at first in Brazil, target both Chrome and Firefox. They are capable of monitoring users' activity to spot when they are logged into Facebook. The extensions then can download a configuration file, the link for which looks like an ordinary website. The file can instruct the malware to do any number of things on its own, such as liking posts and links on Facebook, interacting with groups and with friends of the user in question, and even posting comments and messages via chat. A user gets infected via a Trojan, requiring some way to trick the user into downloading and running a file whose payload actually installs the extension. The post includes some examples of the extension's activities, some of which are clearly trying to trick users into clicking on a link to a malicious website, increasing the risk to users that much more. Microsoft is claiming that its security tools are capable of detecting and removing these extensions. In many ways, they seem to be a somewhat logical evolution of something that was done actually to draw attention to some of the security risks of insecure session management. This seems to bypass this, but the Fire Sheep demonstrator that really had more to do about the insecurities of wireless access that was exacerbated by improper handling, improper encryption of authenticated sessions. This, as I say, bypasses that because it just piggybacks, like most Trojans do, on what's already available for a given user. Users on platforms other than Windows are just as much risk as much as Microsoft is really only talking about their tool. But the article does talk about how users could spot these bogus attentions in what is otherwise a really attractive target, given that it's popular across any number of operating systems, to entice such an attack like this. If users will just look at the list of extensions that they have installed, then they can look to see if they spot any that they don't recall installing manually. I think this is at least slightly ironic, given that Microsoft itself has been caught out installing browser extensions without any explicit interaction from users, though their intent was not to attack. They did it as part of installing some other software just to expand its capabilities. So perhaps in some ways they've learned their lesson, or more likely this is just a different team, a newer team, much more focused on the very laudable goal, despite this source, of keeping people safe online. Another channel at the H, their open channel, described a tool from Bitdefender, this time called Clueful, that can identify applications that are privacy or security risks on the Android mobile platform. It doesn't actually analyze what apps are doing as such in order to, like, behaviorally get at this bit of trickery. Rather, it uses a sort of fingerprinting approach, just recognizing an app from a database that is stored and maintained by Bitdefender. So it does a little bit of lightweight work, not behaviorally based, as I said, but just on maybe name or other aspects that uniquely identify apps, and then doing that comparison remotely via an API call. Problem apps are categorized as low, medium, or high risk, where the degree to which a user is exposed or has their info set to advertising networks and other potential bad actors, anyway, determines which bucket into which it falls. The post includes some sample work the author, along with Heist Security, did. Even though the approach is relatively simple, according to their account, it does appear to be effective. Clueful displays a notification when an app is installed, if it is indeed identified as being a privacy or security risk. The post notes this could be annoying for users who install a lot of apps, although I'd have to imagine for it to rise to the level of annoyance, you'd have to be installing them continuously. If you have a new device where you're installing a whole bunch of other apps, maybe you want to turn this off for the time being, or put up with that inconvenience with the understanding that it will, with most typical usage, I think, level off. It's also not possible to search the database independently, which, if you could do that, would allow for pre-screening of apps, I think a very attractive value if they opened it up that way. I think that would be a lot more ideal. You could, even before you try something out, figure out whether it's going to be a problem. All the same, this sounds like it is worth checking out, especially since the app is free. There was even, at one point, an iOS version of Clueful that was released earlier in the year. Unfortunately, Apple yanked it from the App Store, as there is apparently now a policy amongst the developer agreement against apps examining other apps running outside of their own sandbox. That's unfortunate, and really I think it highlights and reminds us why an at least somewhat more open system affords more innovation, even in areas where walled gardens are perceived and often proselytized as being better, like in this instance, security. Even if Google had a similar policy, the option to load apps from other stores preserves this ability to innovate and provide more value than a single channel can provide with any given set of rules or constraints. Here are the news stories that caught my eye this week. For more, check out the website at thecommandline.net. Slashdot linked to a short blog post from someone working in the field of high-performance computing. That's the area of computer science focused on building machines as fast and powerful as possible. The applications for such supercomputers are usually in physics, in particular simulations. The more operations that can be calculated a second, the more accurate, the more faithful these physical models can be. The poster is a self-identified skeptic of more far-flung ideas such as the singularity and the robo-apocalypse, ideas predicated on runaway acceleration of exactly this sort of computing power, coupled, of course, with artificial intelligence. The person shared this presentation of interest is really just a worker in the field. The presentation itself is by a recognizable expert, a deputy director in a national lab involved in high-performance computing. Horst Steinmann works at Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory and is the presenter in question and was giving this presentation earlier this month to the Optical Interconnects Conference. Steinmann's core contention is that supercomputers won't hit the exaflops milestone by 2020, which some people are predicting is not only possible, but probable. Exa is a prefix meaning 10 to the 18th or a 1 followed by 18 zeros. Flops are floating point operations per second and a common benchmark of raw computing performance. He gives a good survey of the current state of the area, the field of study, and so doing, he identifies three what he calls swim lanes for going forward from systems benchmarked today in the tens of petaflops up the several hundred fold increase that would be needed to hit the exaflops target. He points out one risk that there is right now, choosing or looking across anyway these three potential ways forward, not really a clear winner. Selecting a swim lane to pursue too early risks pursuing one to an unpredictable dead end, but choosing one too late could mean losing the opportunity to have a well-ranked, well-placed machine. The sense I get is that this reputation is key for in particular lab directors, or in this instance deputy directors, both to secure necessary funding and projects of interest that will actually come in and make use of the machine. Not surprisingly, the other thing he identifies is power inefficiency, something that I've talked about recently. In his slide deck, including stacks and stacks of graphs on the subject, there is one market improvement, the adoption by some projects of one of the approaches or swim lanes that he talks about earlier, using GPUs as a basis for supercomputers. These are highly parallel specialized chips normally used for video games and on-the-fly real-time video processing, but really at their base, they're just really good at doing certain forms of mathematical computations really, really fast, so it's not surprising that they would be attractive for this purpose. Simon doesn't think this changes the slope of the graph of predictive future improvements, though. He's pretty clear in his assessment that this was a one-time improvement, just hopping over that to that architecture, and the deflection of the graph, the slope of it after that's consistent with before. Several more slides cover from where the power inefficiency arises. The issue really isn't powering the computational steps themselves, but in the cost of shuttling information around the system. From my own experience and reading over the years, this is a long-standing problem area for supercomputers where the physical systems themselves take up way more space than a desktop tower. We're talking about at the scale that computers before the personal computer revolution took place used to have, that persisting, but instead of it being at a personal scale, a room full of computing hardware has just approached these incredible speeds that we're talking about when we're talking about petaflops or exaflops. Worse, as information has to be shared across that physical space, whether that's a server room or in many cases even a data center, so multiple server rooms together, electrical interconnects require additional power, not just to shuttle those bits around, but to amplify them over the attenuated distances involved. This problem arises even on chip itself, within the core of the computer, but really is made worse by the overall total physical scale of these systems. A appropriate to the venue, he does point out that implementing practical optical interconnects can help, as they don't require the same amplification of the signals that are used to copy bits, shuttling them back and forth over those distances. Simon argues that the exaflops benchmark is a bit flawed anyway, in that the entire field is shifting, exploring new challenges where raw number of computations per unit time just may not be as valid a measure of what can be done with these systems. Reading through his list, some of it resonates with questions I've seen discussed elsewhere around how programming still needs to catch up to make full use of just the three swim lines that he talks about early on. A lot of them really having in common that they're massively parallel. There are plenty of slides in the later portion of the deck that describe the sorts of specific applications that exascale might unlock if we reach it. The most high profile, one focused on by the White House, is of course simulating the human brain. This is factored into some of Obama's recent speeches around science, technology, engineering, and math, and setting some of these sort of like moonshot style goals for basic science research. This one, though, really brings home the power of efficiency problem in the thousands of watts that a computer will need to even approach the brain, which does what it does for meager watts or at most tens of watts. Regardless of Simon's skepticism on the timing, he concludes with a strong argument for why the pursuit of exascale matters. The argument then seems to be for patience to allow sufficient time to solve these key problems rather than over-fixating on arbitrary targets for arbitrary reasons at very arbitrary points in time. Laura Hudson at Wired's Underwire blog was one of many to discuss this next story of some employees at a game company who tackled issues around gender representation with grace, humor, and ultimately, for change, to very good effect. I actually read the employee at Meteor Entertainment's own account of this, though I think both it and Hudson's commentary are worth a read. In short, despite working in what sounds like a very inclusive and aware environment, this person was bothered by a poster of some game art for one of the titles from this particular shop that was displayed prominently and somewhat unconsciously with pride by the company's CEO. If you're familiar with the usual culture of gender dysfunction in tech, video games more specifically, then you may not even need to see the art reproduced in the Wired piece to know what I'm talking about here. It combines a lot of the ridiculousness that projects like the Hawkeye Initiative that Hudson mentions highlight in terms of unrealistic clothing, body portrayal, and even accessories. In this case, combining welding gear with a distinct lack of protective clothing for a female mechanic. The mention of the gender-swapping Hawkeye Initiative is intentional on Hudson's part, as it foreshadows the overall arc of this particular story. If you aren't familiar, the Hawkeye Initiative is a distributed hack on gender in comics, where participating artists redo ridiculously unrealistic comic art portraying women to swap in the bright purple clad, so the original, not the movie portrayal of the bow-toting Avenger. I have seen it touted for skewering these ridiculous representations without necessarily shaming those involved to the degree that dialogue becomes impossible. There's a fair amount of humor in those swapped depictions as well, which seems to invite more conversation and thought than otherwise with other approaches. Back to this particular instance, the anonymous employee enlisted the aid of one of the game company's artists to create a gender-swapped version of the problematic artwork. In a move that could have been very disastrous, the pair then swapped the original poster with the one they created featuring the character that they named Brosie the Riveter. When the CEO saw what they had done, this could have gone badly, as would be typical of most video game offices that I've read or heard about. Consistent with the anonymous worker's intro, however, giving the company credit for being way better than average, the CEO saw the prank for what it was and owned up to his own lack of awareness around these sorts of inclusion issues. He restored the original artwork, but with the new art right beside it. The main point the original post concludes with is to remind us all that often sexism is performed by otherwise well-intentioned people who could use gentle, maybe humorous if that helps, reminders of their better nature to ensure they live up to their potential as allies. Hudson adds that since this story broke, the Hawkeye Initiative has put out a call for brosy moments where folks have moved from discussion to local constructive action. In paying more and more attention to issues around inclusion, as a manager myself, my gut often twists when it comes to trying to understand what to do. Not every situation will be appropriate for a brosy intervention, but it does reinforce my feeling that we can improve things without seeing a lot of the distressing argument that often accompanies work in this space to try to affect better outcomes. Hudson followed up with an interview with K2, the pseudonym of the employee at the heart of the story, in a post same day or within a day of the original one. Reading through it, it really reinforces the positive lessons here, clarifying both the intention, the reaction, and the space of better possibilities. MIT Technology Review had news of research that could make one-time pads more practical. There's a good description of what a one-time pad is in the article. It relates to the application of cryptography of certain mathematics to securing communication. In short, it's some random sequence of information with which messages can be combined, literally added together. A receiver needs a copy of the same pad, then subtracting that pad information back out from an encrypted message in order to recover the original sense. As the article goes on to explain, one-time pads have a couple of challenges. The first is a source of truly random information, one that can create amounts at least as large as any given message to be sent. In the earliest days of secret messages, things like bingo tumblers were used. For a pad to be effective, though, whatever is used has to not introduce any inadvertent patterns, like a lazy operator not, say, turning a tumbler a sufficient number of times, or if you're using a card deck, not shuffling that enough to introduce high enough levels of randomness. The problem has been largely solved with modern systems, like ones based on radioactive decay, where nature is actually taking care of that random distribution. The other problem is that if an attacker gets a copy of a pad, it makes the pad utterly useless. With paper pads, that was bad enough, but in computer systems, making copies of things in memory and electronic storage is pretty much what they do best. Researchers at California's Institute of Technology and colleagues think they have a solution. Like quantum crypto systems, it relies on distinct physical properties of the system in question. What the article goes on to describe is how an optical diffusion glass can be used as a source of random information by shining a pattern of light through it. Unlike a paper or electronic copy of a pad, the glass itself isn't enough to decrypt messages. The pattern of light used as input into that is needed as well. It's still a possible attack vector if someone lays hands on that glass, and the article mentions, if someone does so, that they would need as much as 24 hours in order to find the right pattern. The limiter here is that shining light through the glass generates heat in the medium. Too much heat can shift the microstructure of the glass, which would break its ability to reproduce the exact same outputs, the same key parts that were originally produced for any given message. Already encoded messages would be exposed eventually, but the users could switch to new glass slabs. Both parties would not actually need exact copies of the same glass. This is another thought that I had reading it. It said, how would they do that? It seems like that would be manifestly difficult, if not impossible. The glass is actually used to create a combined key. So each produces an output from their glass that is a further input to some operation to generate a shared key. One that, again, still needs to be as long as a message or a sequence of prospective future messages that two parties would be exchanging. Actually, when the two parties come together to use their glass for this purpose, they need to do that generation ahead of time. They don't want to have to keep reconvening where errors could be introduced or one of the glasses could be stolen. It wouldn't be very practical, but the system can handle this quite well, at least in theory, having a single meeting producing quite enough data. Basically, rather than just generating that one key for that one message, using many with many sequences of input light pulses through the same glass pairs just by changing those patterns of light that they send into them. The researchers have already demonstrated creating keys sufficient for 10 gigabits of data. That's quite a bit. You could actually imagine them utilizing this system for exchanging not just textual messages, but also possibly video and voice. Once they've exhausted the reasonable sequences they can get from the glass without repeating and reintroducing another possible weakness into the overall use of this approach. They can actually just use that other advantage that the glass labs have that I talked about if someone were able to steal one, heating the glasses a little bit or gradually to alter their microstructure, effectively creating all new, completely distinct and random generators. I don't expect this to end up on the desktops of typical users, even with the time that undoubtedly will be put in to make this more practical, but could easily see something of utilitarian use coming of this soon for the kinds of critical communications where one-time pads were originally used, say for secure military dispatches, or even maybe in the realms of finance. MIT Technology Review had further news of a breakthrough in another field of interest of mine in the area of advanced computing, this time quantum systems. The article provides some good background on a model proposed by Bruce Kane back in the 1990s. An Australian physicist, he suggested using a single phosphorus atom embedded in a silicon substrate. The materials involved are easily produced in modern fabs. These are elements that are already available in the electronics that we're used to, that are surrounding us and that we carry with us very often. And using the spin of the phosphorus atom would allow it to store a qubit value for a very long time. It offered incredible stability to that quantum spin state that's used to represent that interesting admixture, that quantum admixture of the otherwise two polar values of a traditional classical information bit. Reading and writing the spin states also requires readily available NMR, a nuclear magnetic resonance components, and can be interfaced quite readily with traditional electronics, so you could have a hybrid system, some of which we're already seeing using other models. The challenge with this idea is that the two atoms spin, if you want to actually have more than a single qubit, cannot be made to interact directly. In order to scale this up, then, this simple and practical approach, Kane refined it to use the spin state of one of the electrons orbiting the phosphorus atom, and then further electrons on that same atom or other electrons of other adjacent atoms actually could be made to interact. And then addressing those two electrons would allow a two-qubit operation to proceed and could be theoretically scaled up by just simply involving more electrons. Unfortunately, reading and writing the spin state of the orbiting electrons is not as simple as doing so with the spin of the atom itself. This past week, Jared Plott at the University of New South Wales in Sydney and his colleagues said they had surmounted this obstacle that Australian researchers have been working on for over a decade. The researchers embedded a phosphorus atom in a silicon nanostructure to trap it. They then placed this into a strong magnetic field at super low temperature and were able to flip the spin state of its electrons with a microwave pulse. Reading that state proved a bit harder than setting it, but they were able to demonstrate a technique that utilized a process called spin-to-charge conversion, so presumably taking advantage of some means of directly correlating that spin state, exactly what value of the qubit they've encoded with an electrical current back through a more traditional electronic interface, so hying back to one of the advantages of Kane's original idea. This device potentially could be scaled up to involve two qubits. They haven't demonstrated that yet, but it seems like it's just a matter of lab time to fully implement and realize the potential of Kane's idea. Kane's model, as it turns out, is not the only way to approach this milestone. And the article does mention both D-Wave, which has been in the news, and I've talked about them a little bit, especially early on, and another bit of research using nitrogen vacancies in diamond lattices. I've also talked about that latter research, especially as it has sort of a science fictional appeal. If you read Ender's Game, that series, especially the later books, the protagonist in that actually had I don't know that it was ever called a quantum computer, but had a hyper-intelligent sentient computer embedded in a diamond earring, of all things. But here, with Kane's approach and with the work that these researchers have done, the key advantage, as the article explains, is that the phosphorus atom model is much easier to interface with traditional electronics, making it easier to actually do useful things with it. The work here is still very much in the lab stages, though, temperature being an obvious barrier to a more commercially viable version, as is often the case with these very early day sorts of experiments on these interesting approaches. As the article points out, there are still probably at least a few years ahead before a Kane-style quantum system will compete with the already available D-Wave model, though the electron spin technique is definitely much closer to a more general purpose quantum computer. Some of the stories that catch my attention during the week are actually continuations of stories or themes that I've discussed before. I like to set aside a little extra time to go over those and follow up. Torrent Freak was one source that covered the news a couple of weeks ago that France's three-strike system is being brought to an end, at least as it is. Prompted by the French culture minister last year, a 9-member panel just issued a report making clear that Hadopi, the body responsible for the system, has been anything but a success. The key detail mentioned in the post is that after spending millions of euro, the agency only collected a single 150 euro fine. Unfortunately, the panel is recommending that the copyright enforcement scheme not be ended altogether, but rather that it should be transferred to a new existing agency and to continue, though, without the threat of disconnection, the most troubling aspect of this first attempt at a three-strikes regime. Instead, after two offenses on that third one, an automated system would issue fines, ones that, as if I'm understanding this, would just be the same size, that there wouldn't be a so-called graduated response leading to some further penalty, hence consistent with that understanding that it wouldn't ultimately lead to a disconnect. This was one recommendation of many that will be reviewed in the coming months by lawmakers for a report back later on the summer on related issues around intellectual property enforcement in France. Microsoft's next video gaming console, the Xbox One, was announced this past week. According to Shack News via a link from Nat Torkington's four short links on the O'Reilly Radar site, it will continue policies first established with the Xbox 360 that make it impossible for indie gamers to easily self-publish their titles through the sole online distribution channel available for this platform. Instead, smaller gamers will need to get a publishing deal with Microsoft, which will involve a not insignificant investment for smaller scale players, or through some other third party who already has such a deal in place. This is entirely consistent with the lack of backward compatibility by default that I posted about earlier this week. In both cases, the issue seems to be money and control, that while these things are technically possible, they cannot be done without paying for the privilege on an entirely arbitrary basis. I'm hoping that new entrants like the Steambox from Valve and the Ouya, the crowd-funded Android-based entirely open gaming platform, make popular, less restrictive, more open alternatives to show that those models can be as successful, if not more, while being much more fair both to gamers and to game creators. That's going to do it for this episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening, and if you enjoyed the program, please do tell a friend. Or go to the website at thecommandline.net and click on the support link for all the ways you can financially help out with the production of the show. If you have a question, suggestion, or correction, you can send those to feedback at thecommandline.net, or you can post those as a comment up on the website. If you're away from your computer and the internet at the moment, call the listener comment line at area code 240-949-2638. If you need to get in touch with me securely, details of my public key pair can be found at thecommandline.net/GNUPG-fingerprints. The next show should go out on time in the feed next week, and as I mentioned, should feature an interview with Bruce Schneier. So until then, don't forget to hack your world. I would like to thank the Internet Archive for media hosting and bandwidth. The views expressed on this program are my own, and where applicable, those of my guests, and in no way reflect those of my employer or anyone else. This show is produced from 100% recycled bits. Except where noted, permission to recycle those further is granted under the Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 United States license. That means you're free to change this show as much as you like, as long as you don't alter credits and you share your changes under the same license.